Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Morrow. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with James P. Allison, PhD, from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, to discuss his biggest career milestones. Dr. Allison is a giant of cancer care in the scientific advances category, which he received in 2014. In 2018, the Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute awarded him, along with Tetsuko Honjo, MD, PhD, the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for their work that led to the use of checkpoint inhibitors in cancer treatment. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Allison highlighted everything from his proudest professional moments to MD Anderson's Moonshot program, to his musical talents, to next steps he's taking in cancer research. Welcome, Dr. Allison.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you here. So since winning the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, what has been the focus of your research? What plans do you have for future studies?
Well, what realized since the, actually was beginning to realize it about the time of the Nobel Prize was that while we, for the first time, I think that checkpoint blockade and other immunotherapies offer curative, truly curative therapies, but the number of the fraction of patients responding is relatively small at this point. I mean, what we know, for example, is that with melanoma monotherapy with ipilimumab, a little over 20% of people are alive 10 years after a single round of treatment, which is pretty good, but why did 100? Well, when PD-1 came along and was added to it, that went up to a little over 50%. And that's out, that trial is out, long, randomized trial is out long enough now. There's 5 years follow-up, and it's still above 50%, which is, considering that when we started this work, the median survival with melanoma was 7 months, and fewer than 3% of people were alive at 5 years, and there was no drug approved. I mean, greater than 50% is pretty good, but why not 100, and in bladder, it's 30 to 40%, why not higher? And so that's what I've been doing with my scientific partner in transparency, my partner in life too, Pam Sharma, who's MD, PhD. We formed a thing here at MD Anderson we call the Immunotherapy Platform. And it's sort of, I've been a basic scientist all my life, just sort of considered I dabbled in immunotherapy a little bit. But I think, then I sort of became a translational guy. But now we're really doing reverse translations. What we do, it's really clinical trial-based work, where we get specimens from patients on trials and then take them back to the laboratory and look at mechanism and try to get insight into, new combinations. What do you see? Because we know what a good, from the successes, we know what a good signal looks like. We know the components of it. It's not just T cells, it's myeloid cells. We're beginning to realize that fibroblasts can play a role. So it's more complicated than we thought. So we're trying to dissect that, take the clinical stuff back to the laboratory, dissect it, then go to mouse experiments to test hypotheses, and then go back with an iteration of change to try to change what's going on. And it's been quite successful. I think we've made a lot of progress, particularly in GU cancers. And, we're beginning to start looking at things like GBM and pancreatic cancer that have been pretty recalcitrant so far. It's now trying to make these therapies work better.
Thank you so much for that insight. And it really sounds like some very, very interesting research going on. You were also the first recipient to win the Nobel Prize from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. What did it mean to you to bring this back to the institution where you have spent so much of your career?
It meant a lot because over the years, Anderson has done a lot for me. I had my very first faculty appointment was at MD Anderson, not at the Houston campus, but in a smaller campus that they built called the Science Park, actually Interstate Park near Austin. And I'd been interested in immunology in T cells since I was an undergraduate and had a professor. They'd just really been discovered and were first being recognized in the late 60s when I was an undergraduate. I decided that's what I want to do. I was a biochemist, but I wanted to work on them. And I didn't really have a chance until I got that faculty job. I did my postdoc in an immunology lab, but I had to do protein purification and stuff because they want to take advantage of my skills, you know what I mean? But anyway, I came to Anderson and I had a project that I was hired to do. But then I, on the side, indulged my curiosity and worked out the structure of the T cell antigen receptor for the first time in 1981, and that sort of propelled me to other stuff. But that early work was all done at Anderson because I had the freedom to and the support to just do what I wanted to do without regard of anybody saying, "Oh, you got to do this administrative stuff, teaching all this." I was really lucky. Anyway, so after 20 years at Berkeley and 10 years at Sloan Kettering, I'm back there now and working again, you know, and trying to do the sort of stuff I told you about. But one of the things I'll never forget is when I came back from Stockholm, and I basically did a walkthrough with Peter Pisters, the president of the Anderson. We walked through the hospital, and there were hundreds, literally, of people, you know, patients, staff, you know, people like that, just cheering. And it was just such a outpouring of, you know, of love and, you know, just such a positive thing. You know, I was really happy to have been able to bring something back, you know, that meant so much to everyone who was there. So it's really been a privilege to do that.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's been such an exciting journey. Was there ever a point during the development of ipilimumab that you thought, hey, this may not work? Or did you always know that you would find a way? And what were the challenges that you faced to get to the finish line?
Well, the biggest challenge was just at the time was the bias against immunotherapy. I considered myself a basic scientist. I was actually working on mechanisms of regulation of T cell responses, you know. And every now and then, when I got something that I thought might be useful in cancer, I would jump into cancer for a while and try something and learn something, and then jump back and go to the next step on the mechanism until finally I was able to put this thing together. And that if you block checkpoints, you could unleash the immune system against T cells. And, you know, I knew people got to be skeptical. So we did the work in many kinds of strains of mice, many different tumors, so that it worked essentially always, either as a monotherapy or if you added a little chemotherapy or radiation or vaccine or something. We didn't ever find, they were all transplantable lines, but that we couldn't cure. And but people didn't challenge the data. They just challenged the whole notion of immunotherapy. You know, they said, it's not worked, it'll never work. And I said that, you know, how can you say that, you know, if you don't try it? You know, this is mechanism based. This is, you know, most of the other stuff has been people doing things that they really didn't know how they work. And I did the mechanism first. So I'll put this up, you know, I'll bet anything. So I never thought it wouldn't work. I just thought there was a significant chance I wouldn't be able to convince anybody to take a chance on. In fact, it took 3 years of going around from company to company. I won't list the ones who told me to take a hike. But finally, the only way it worked out, actually, is a friend of mine, Alan Corman, had a friend, Niels Lomberg, who had a little company that was called Geneform first, and it was called Metarex, that had a mouse that replaced the mouse genes with human immunoglobulin genes. So they could immediately make a human antibody ready to go to the clinic. But they didn't really have any application, and so it was the perfect, you know, wedding, if you were. So we came together, and then after that it happened really quickly. They made an antibody in no time, and you know, went to the clinic, and you know, and then, you know, in one of the phase 1/2 trials, 14 I think it was patients, there were 3 objective responses in a safety trial, you know, objective responses. One of them is still alive 20 years later now, so that kind of turned it around. But to the best of my ability of the science, I was convinced it would work. I was worried there might be adverse events. I was worried about a lot of stuff, but I thought the principle was sound because it was based on, you know, mechanism. And the thing, you know, the thing that depressed me after a while was just that nobody would listen.
I can't believe some of the comments that you would experience from people back in the day, and I'm sure they're all kicking themselves now.
Well, it did change. You know, first they said it never worked, and then the next one was, well, it's just a melanoma drug, you know, and then it's still, frankly, I think it wasn't until the Nobel Prize that people finally said, hey, that works.
But that's a very good point. And you touched on this a little bit already, but aside from ipilimumab, what clinical changes or impacts have really manifested as a result of your findings?
Well, I think that one of the things that happened was the demonstration that PD-1 was a checkpoint before it was thought to be a molecule that played a role in negative selection of T cells in the thymus. But as our phase one data was coming out, I mean, the question then was, why just 20% melanoma? There's some mechanistic explanations, but of course the cooler one, more interesting one scientifically, was maybe there are other checkpoints because CTLA-4 was the first. And sure enough, Gordon Freeman and Arlene Sharp worked with Hanjo and showed that PD-1 was one of them. And together they have different mechanisms. Together it's dynamite. And then since then, terms are used loosely now, but it's really put, I think, IO or immuno-oncology on the map where, you know, everybody's doing it. And led to the fact that immunotherapy isn't voodoo. It's, in fact, the fourth pillar of cancer therapy now and needs to be recognized that way. And it's, you know, it's truly curative and can be curative. And we just need to work harder on understanding how to combine all the riches that we've got now, all the new molecules that are coming, some of, you know, from many labs and new combinations with more conventional therapies, you know. And I think that, I mean, I've been just amazed at the magnitude of immuno-oncology these days and, you know, where it's going. And I think that if we just do it right and pay attention to the science, I think hopefully we're going to be curing a lot more people with cancer.
Absolutely. Very well said. Now, MD Anderson's Moonshot program launched in 2021 and brought you back to the institution. What are the significant changes that you have seen with this program in the last 10 years?
Well, I was actually there when I'd agreed to come back before they launched that, just to be accurate. But that was started by Ron DePino, and the idea was to put a lot of money, build teams to capture the low-hanging fruit and make rapid advances as a way of showing that we could do something about cancer. And it's been reasonably successful there, but they've widened it now where there is a GBM moonshot, there's a pancreatic moonshot. So it's expanded and has provided, you know, money for building teams and still quite a force here, getting people together to approach the cancers as a unit rather than just individuals.
Yes, and now this is very interesting in today's environment. Cal Berkeley, your former professional home, has issued an NFT based on an artistic image of your work to raise money for its research efforts. Did you have any part in its creation? And what do you think of this as a way to fund clinical investigation?
Whatever it takes. No, but I didn't. They tell me about it, but they didn't really discuss it with me until they did it. But what I thought was really cute was there was in the original patent application, and I'd forgotten about this, but they showed me this. There was one experiment in there, and I'd circled it and just wrote in the margin, "This is what has me really excited," and put arrows, you know, to it. And so that's on the replica in metal, you know, on that thing that. And my son saw that and he said, "I want to go through all your papers, Dad, you know." But I think whatever it takes. I mean, Berkeley, you know, I mean, that they gave me the freedom to really, again, you know, a place, very creative place where not a lot of, you know, applied things go on, or did not back then when I was there. But it was a place where there were a lot of smart people, terrific students, and new ideas were really appreciated and also challenged immediately. You know, you a bad idea didn't last very long at Berkeley. And so it really sort of, you know, honed you to all the smart people around you. You got tested, really. You had to be careful not so careful about what you said, but you had to be willing to give stuff up quickly when people showed you were wrong.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. I'd also like to mention your closest collaborator and wife. You mentioned her earlier, Dr. Padmini Sharma, an oncologist working at MD Anderson in genitourinary cancer. She was also very accomplished. In 2017, the Washington Post labeled the two of you the cancer-fighting power couple. That's high praise. How does that dynamic work for both of you?
It works well. Early on, you know, there was, I wouldn't say tension, but, you know, I was a lot further along in my career than Pam, so she was worried about, you know, being in my shadow or something. But she's got her own strengths, you know, independent of mine and everything. So I think we just quit worrying about that. And, you know, we work very well together, you know, together. We publish together most of the time. And we both contribute to everything. And I don't know, it's sort of fun in a way, you know. I mean, we really enjoy working together and arguing about, we don't always agree on stuff, but that's fine. You know, you're not supposed to agree all the time, you know. And get along, but we both enjoy it. And there's certain advantages to having, you know, two people together. Anyway, I was amazed when I saw that article, though. I thought, wow.
I love that. It's a great title. Yes. Since you yourself have experienced what it is like to be both the researcher in oncologic treatments and a patient, having beaten cancer 3 times, not to mention that you have had several family members succumb to various cancers, how did the perspective on your research change? Was there a heightened sense of urgency?
Yes, I think so. There was a lot of urgency when, to be honest, in the early days of IPI, when we finally got the antibody made and were in the clinic, I was trying to hurry it along because my older brother had metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer, and I was hoping that, you know, we might be able to treat him. But also, I learned, though, that, you know, there's only so fast you can go. You know, anyway, we didn't get there early enough, but it certainly made me appreciate, you know, doing your work, doing it efficiently, trying not to waste time doing silly things, to try to make everything, you know, science-based, mechanism-based that you can, and just to do good work. It's the speed is important, but not as important as getting it right.
Very, very well said. Now, you are also well-known, and maybe notorious is a better word, as a musician. Do the Checkpoints have any plans to get together soon?
Our two traditional meetings are SITC, which is kind of the house band of the Society of Immunotherapy of Cancer, and probably a lot of people have been to our annual concerts there. We started at big parties and a lot of fun. And then also ASCO is a big one where we played at. Of course, those have been suspended for the last 2 years.
I saw you a few years ago. I really enjoyed it. You're very talented. Have you been able to play at all since the pandemic started? Any kind of virtual shows going on?
We've done a few small things, you know, together, but not really. I mean, I'm doodle around at home sometimes. And
you also famously had a jam session with Willie Nelson. Have you played with anyone else of note, and what prompted you to learn that instrument?
I played with a few other people. Willie's probably the best known. I started playing when I was a kid. You know, I was in Boy Scouts or something. I don't remember why, but I just picked it up. I liked to play while I was out camping or walking around the woods around my house or something. And then when I was a postdoc at Scripps Clinic, I ran into some expatriate Texans who were surfers, but they had a country and western band, and I started sitting in with them and played 2 nights a week, I guess, for most of my postdoc with this band at a place called the Stingeree, which was started by a guy named Jack Temption, who wrote "Peaceful Easy Feeling" by the Eagles, so he used to come down. Anyway, I sat in with some studio musicians from LA a few times, and that was a lot of fun. But Willie, going that famous night, is Willie came to town for the Columbia Record Convention that year, and his first record had gone platinum. So they had a big celebration for him, and I crashed that party. I found out where it was, and I just snuck in, you know, through the security and chatted up, you know, because I'd seen him 50 times in Austin, you know, after we were there. And anyway, I ended up taking him the next night. You know, I was talking to him. He said, "Oh, you live here?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, is there any place I could play? Because I have tomorrow night off." And I thought, "You have tomorrow night off and you're going to go play. Okay." So I said, "It's talent night at the Stingeree." And so I took him to talent night at the Stingeree the next night. And so that was pretty famous. But the last time I played in public, I'll tell you, was on March 6th last year when Willie played the Houston Rodeo. I sat in with him. in front of 74,000 people. And so that was the last time either one of us played. And about 6 weeks ago or so, though, he had a party down at his ranch, and I went down. I played with him several times, but he was playing live, in front of an audience for the first time since that rodeo performance. And I didn't get to play with him because they're worried about COVID, so they kind of kept him away from everybody. But he was warming up to go on tour again, and they invited me down and thought I could sit in, but then decided no, really decided nobody. He wants a curtain around him, people from the band that he knows are not, So because he's 88, if he gets sick, it's going to be bad. So but anyway, I'm looking forward to sitting in with him again whenever I can, and then also playing with the chick. And we also have a band, a local band in Houston that we play. Some of the same people as the Checkpoints that are from MD Anderson. All of us have another band here, and we play for cancer charities and things around Houston. Have a lot of fun. So, of course, we haven't done that either in the last year, but we're going to get that started up again soon.
Very nice. What cool experiences. Not everybody can say that they've played with Willie Nelson. That's very exciting.
Somebody a few years ago went to the Vatican for some stuff, and somebody said, "Well, you met the Pope and you played with Willie Nelson, which is," I said, I don't know. I think maybe Willie."
I love that. You have been named as a giant of cancer care. You were named an inductee in 2014 in Scientific Advances. What does that mean to you to be recognized as a giant in the field of oncology as identified by the very folks who are in the same fight with you?
Well, it was pretty amazing. I mean, I was quite honored and surprised, because I consider myself a basic immunologist, and who did the work. I mean, I always had cancer in the back of my mind, but I didn't wake up every day trying to think about curing cancer necessarily. In fact, well, now I do, but back then, in fact, when I went to Sloan Kettering, I gave an interview and I said, I don't wake up every day trying to understand how to cure cancer. I wake up every day trying to understand the details of the immune system so that I can use those to try to treat cancer. People said, "You don't think about cancer every day? Well, what the hell are you doing here then?" It's kind of the attitude, But then I realized, well, I guess they appreciate it, with that award, the Giants of Cancer. So I mean, wow, something for basic scientists.
Absolutely. Very, very well deserved as well. Now, over your lifetime, what has been your proudest personal moment and your proudest professional moment?
The proudest professional moment, perhaps, was being at ASCO when, the registration trial for IPI was presented. That may be both the personal and the professional moment, after I realized it's been worth it. This is here now, it's treating people. It's going to help a lot of people. I think that was it. I mean, I don't know what it was going to mean, but just seeing the presentation and everybody just going nuts, it was, I was told, and I don't know if it's true or not, but there was the biggest session at ASCO like forever, because most of the time it was failures were presented, we're almost there, but this was a curative therapy, and it was going to change everything, and the buzz and all the excitement and everything was just all over, and I was just in the middle of it, just awed, and so happy about it.
That must have been such a special moment. I would have loved to see video or some kind of flashbacks from that room. It must have been so amazing to be a part of.
Because I'd started going to ASCO a few years before, and the immunologists would be meeting in small rooms, or they'd be in a big room and there'd be two rows of people, and then the session would change and fill up with all the TKI guys, the genomics guys, and then they'd leave with 50 immunologists would come back, and now it's the opposite. At AACR one year, I spoke to 12,000 people. It was amazing. It's a giant number of people as far as I could see. But it changed from like 5 years earlier, where it would, like I said, it'd be 50 or 75 or something.
Quite a big difference, yes. Dr. Allison, you have been recognized for your achievements more than 55 times, named a Nobel laureate, a giant, a musician. When all is said and done, what do you hope that people will say about you?
I hope that people say the world is a better place for my having been here and doing what I did, that's all.
That's wonderful. Dr. Allison, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. This has been very much time well spent, and you are undoubtedly a giant in cancer care. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.